And you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio here on Kansas City's Community Radio. It is Monday morning. My name is Beth Pike. And on our broadcast today, our host Nancy Leeser is going to talk with Danita Horde.
And Danita is a student at UMKC. And her mentor, Dr. Joan McDowd, from UMKC, they're going to talk about their efforts to form support groups for grandparents that are raising their grandchildren. And if you missed the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's announcement of the new rules governing the payday and car title loan industry, well, stay tuned. We are going to have that and play it back. It was a recording that we had done with Richard Cordray, who's the director of the CFPB, and he'll be telling you all about the proposed views. We're not going to be reading the calendar today or playing the 420 drug war news this week so that we can ask you for your support of KKFI and Jaws of Justice Radio. Nancy and her guests are going to be up right after this message.
Good morning. My name is Nancy Leeser, and our guests this morning are Dr. Joan McDowd and Danita Horde, and they're going to tell us a little bit about their program to help grandparents who are raising their grandchildren. First of all, would each of you tell us a little bit about yourselves, Dr. McDowd?
Sure. Thanks for having us. I'm a professor in psychology at UMKC and also director of the UMKC Consortium for Aging in Community. And we are trying to develop more and more programs that reach out and really address the problems of the community.
Thank you. And Danita?
Thanks for having us, Nancy. Yes, I was actually raised by my grandparents. At least they played a primary role in my upbringing, my brothers and I. And so that's one way that I'm kind of tied to this. I am also a student at the in the graduate program of social work there at UMKC, but my undergrad is in psychology, and that's how Dr. McDowd became my mentor.
Excellent. Thank you. Dr. McDowd, would you tell us a little bit why you started this program?
Sure. We began by working with the Palestine Missionary Baptist Church, and we had some collaboration there. We put together a team to try and identify some issues related to aging. And one of the things that came up is the importance of intergenerational interaction, and through a variety of conversations, that sort of led to the problem of grandparents raising grandchildren. So it's a very powerful dynamic in terms of the intergenerational exchange, but there is also a lot of challenges associated with grandparents raising grandchildren.
And Danita, how did you get involved with the program?
Well, being one of Dr. McDowd's students, she came up with this idea, and she approached me when it was really kind of a serendipity, because when she first talked about it, we didn't have a whole lot of plans. But because of my background, understanding the primary role that grandparents play in their grandchildren's lives, I immediately thought, this is a great opportunity for me. And so I was just, it's something I'm passionate about, and I was glad when she came to me with the opportunity.
That's great. So how did you get the group started? I assume that it was within the structure of the Palestine Missionary Baptist Church?
Yes, it was. The first thing that we did was attend their block party, which they had last summer. And there were a bunch of tables set up in terms of information and health opportunities. And so we had a table there, and Danita and another student were there, and I sent them out to sort of work the crowd and talk to people who looked like they might be grandparents. And so we were just trying to gauge interest and need. And so we had grandparents sort of telling us what their challenges were in terms of raising their grandchildren, and just asking them whether they would be interested in participating in a support group.
Why don't you tell us, Danita, a little bit about some of the challenges that these families are facing?
Yeah, many of the families, one of the challenges that we have found is they're more informal with the grandparents raising their grandchildren, which is to say it's not exactly under legal. So it's a more or less a, you take the children down and, you know, take care of them until I can kind of get back on my feet, which at that point it doesn't allow them to qualify for any sort of financial assistance or any other type of resources. So what we found is that some of these grandparents are raising the grandchildren on their own income, which is most of the time Social Security. They're on Social Security checks. And so our goal had become at that point, once we kind of sat down and talked, what can we do to help these families? What can we do to help put them in touch with resources to help kind of ease the burden of raising the grandchildren? Plus, not to mention all the stresses, the mental stress and those types of things that grandparents may endure while raising the grandchildren, starting all over again, raising a new set of children.
And when you say there's no official legal custody arrangement, it's not that there's nothing illegal about it. It's just that
they haven't gone through the court system to attain the proper documentation to say you are the custodial parent of this child. It's, you know, again, a verbal, more or less a verbal agreement of, well, I can't take care of my children. Mom's going to take care of them, or, you know, I'm going to step in and take my grandchildren because the parents are unable for whatever reason. Some are incarcerated. Some have, you know, died. Some just, you know, maybe on drugs or what. But for whatever reason, these grandparents have ended up with their grandchildren. And oftentimes they, you know, the communication barriers, the generational gaps of communication, all those problems are there. And so we're trying to step in to say, hey, how can we help? What do you need from us?
I can imagine that that uncertain kind of arrangement would lead to some of its own difficulties for both the grandparents and the children.
Right. As great as the challenges are in raising children, these children often have additional challenges because frequently there is some sort of trauma in their lives that has led to them having to leave their family and have their grandparents raise them or take over parenting them. And these traumas can be anything from physical or mental health issues experienced by their parents, the death of a parent, as Danita mentioned, incarceration. Sometimes it's just poverty and generations have to live together. So the parents might be present in the home, but because they are working, might be working two jobs, the grandparents are primarily responsible for childcare and looking after these children.
Do you have any actual data about the number of both the grandparents and children who are in this kind of a situation? And I understand that it's probably a fairly fluid.
Yes, and it's hard. It's hard to count, but we do have some census data that says across the country, across the United States, there are almost 3 million families where grandparents are responsible for their grandchildren. In the state of Missouri, it's about 50,000 families. And just here in the Kansas City metro area, it's over 9,000 families where grandparents are the head of household and having primary responsibility for raising their grandchildren. So it's a big problem.
It is. So in terms of actual numbers, that 9,000 would translate into like 30,000 people affected?
Yes. I mean, most households have more than one grandchild.
Right.
Is that? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the grandparents, are they, is it often a couple, or is it sometimes even single grandparent trying to do this on his or her own?
It's both. We have found where there's a couple and single family or single parent, grandparent raising the grandchildren. Just from my own personal experience, I was fortunate enough to have both my grandparents living, and they both were able to kind of take care of our needs. But even still, with grandma at home and only, you know, grandpa or papa going out to work, it is still a strain on the family.
Yes, absolutely.
There are, it's true, there are couples and single grandparents and but by and large, it is the single grandmother who is trying to raise these grandchildren.
And typically, what are the ages, or maybe there's nothing typical about it, what ages of children are we talking about?
There is nothing typical about it. It's all the way from infancy all the way up through high school.
Yeah. All right. So what kind of, it's not hard to imagine what kind of resources these families need. So what is it that you're trying to do to help discover and connect them?
Well, one of the One of the main needs is sort of, one grandmother expressed it recently to me as, and I'm sure parents experience this as well, just the need to have some adult time. Mm-hmm. So if you have small grandchildren in the house and they consume you, you just need a break. Mm-hmm. And so sort of stress reduction is one of our primary aims in our groups. Allowing grandparents the opportunity to get together and to talk to one another about sharing the particular issues that they may be facing and solutions, mm-hmm. Getting advice from one another. So at Palestine Church, we have started a small group, and we're meeting, started out once a month, and then we ended up meeting twice a month for the group to get together, and we had different topics each week, from behavior problems in your grandchildren to managing stress, to self-esteem, in building self-esteem in your grandchildren. And so we find grandparents talking to one another, asking advice, you know, what did you do in this situation? And people really sharing. Mm-hmm. And the grandparents have really enjoyed that opportunity just to express themselves with like-minded people who are experiencing a lot of the same thing.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of the grandparents have found it helpful to, like she's kind of saying, to share their struggles with like-minded people in terms of, I'm not going through this alone. I'm not doing this by myself. There's others out here that's dealing with the same mental stress and struggles that I am, or feeling exhausted. And so they know this allows grandparents to know they're not alone, that there's others in the same situation as them, and there's someone there to.
I can imagine how that important and how helpful that would be to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they have these get-togethers, is there child care available, like at the church?
Well, we planned for that, but in this particular case, these grandmas have school-age children, so during the day their children were primarily in school.
Oh, so the meetings take place
during
the
day. Over the lunch hour, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So some of them, of course, because the kids are in school during the school year anyway, have a little relief during that time.
Yes. One of the things that we would like to do is try to find ways to expand our program so that we can reach more grandparents, recognizing that we might need an evening session, because we had more grandparents interested than we were able to accommodate in this group just due to scheduling problems. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes the grandparents are dealing with these kids and also working during the day.
So, yes, right. I can imagine. My own background is in corrections, and I know from my personal experience that a lot of people in corrections were subject to childhood trauma. So what resources are available? So I'm particularly sensitive to that topic. What resources are available for these kids?
Well, there are resources available for those kind of kids through their schools and through different kinds of community groups. And really our goal is to, on an individual basis, assess the needs of a family and then try to connect those people to resources. So we are not the resource, the grassroots resource, but we are the group who wants to try and say, hey, this is what's available out there. And so we try to address those needs on a sort of a case-by-case basis.
Okay. Danita, do you want to talk a little bit about the resources that you're attempting to find for the for these grandparents?
Yes. Well, one of the first things we're planning to do is to go ahead and get a website set up where grandparents can actually go on there and link, because sometimes one challenge can be is grandparents may not be as comfortable using the internet and, you know, accessing it and moving around. So to be able to go online and click on this link or call, and we can talk to them and walk them through, like, maybe you can call here. We actually have a booklet that we put together of various resources, like for groceries or help with utilities, those types of things that like you say, it's kind of it, we know what people need. We have that book available for people, but the thing of it is to try to get the website up so that grandparents can go on there, click on those links, and find where they need to go. And if they don't find that help, then to call. And I think it's important to mention we do return phone calls. If you were to call and leave a message, we do return all phone calls.
Why don't you give us that number?
Sure. That is 816-235-2490. That's 816-235-2490. And that is my office phone. And if you leave a message, we, as Danita says, we will get back to you.
Okay, excellent. And if somebody would like to get involved or they have an idea of a resource that might be available, what do you, I mean, I guess
yeah,
the first
we will
question.
Take those kinds of calls as well. As Danita was saying there, AARP, a number of years ago, produced a booklet about grandparents raising grandchildren in the state of Missouri. I think it was AARP Missouri. And so what we did last year was take that booklet, and we had a group of students who then investigated everything that was in the booklet to update it. I mean, phone numbers change, websites change, things like that. So then we have an updated version, but so that's the kind of thing that we would like to post on our website. And if getting on the internet is not easy or not possible, then people can give us a call, and we will try to address those needs. But the idea is we call our group GPS, Grandparent Support, and so we have the idea that it's a journey, and we can help you find your way. That's kind of the image that we're trying to put out there. So we can connect people to resources, and that's an easy thing for us to do.
What about housing? I could imagine that somebody who may, a grandparent as they've aged, are living alone or in a small apartment and then take on this additional responsibility. How is housing a challenge for these grandparents?
Yes, housing is a huge challenge. And one solution that has been put forth in Kansas City is there is an apartment complex called Pemberton Park at Cleveland and Swope Parkway. And it is an apartment building that you have to be a grandparent raising your grandchildren in order to live there. So it is a very nice existing resource. So everyone who lives next to you is in the same situation that you're in. So it is kind of its own little support network there. And it's a nice, the apartments are very nice. I've been there a number of times, have toured the apartments. They have 2, 3, and 4 bedroom apartments there for grandparents. So if you have a number of grandchildren, they can accommodate that.
Right. Is there more housing such as that in the works that you know of?
Not that I know of here in Kansas City. And
none that I know of.
You know, one of the other initiatives that we're working on is an idea of neighboring. And so aging in the community is possible if there is a community. And so if we get people to understand that they can work together and for mutual benefit, then I think this neighboring idea can be very powerful.
And would that possibly mean they could, you know, take turns taking care of each other's children?
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, formally, there are other kinds of housing models like co-housing, where you might share a home in exchange for childcare. But I think if we can get people organized, then any kinds of these sorts of exchange relationships could be developed.
Right. And what about meals, just thinking on a real practical basis? I mean, an older single grandparent or a couple, you know, your eating patterns change as you age, and I can imagine how difficult it would be to start, you know, rethinking how
Yeah,
you
that's
do.
A good yeah. thought that I had never actually considered.
Well, one grandparent kind of said that it's kind of funny because their grandchild wanted to eat a hot dog, and they're saying, well, I can't eat a hot dog.
Right.
And so just, yeah, that ideal of having to prepare something for the grandchild may be different from them, like their meal. Maybe they need to be on like a heart healthy diet or something like that. But the kid wants hot dogs and potato chips. So yeah, that is definitely something else in the home that grandparents have to contend with.
And that's not something that ever goes away.
No, it's not.
What's on the top of your wish list for this group?
I think we really appreciate opportunities like this to get the word out. And I think that's been one of our challenges, because a lot of times the grandparents are just so busy that mm-hmm. they can't even take advantage of potential resources, or they don't know about them. And so we are we've done some programs. We have a program that's right now just in the planning stages through the Concerned Clergy Coalition. They're doing a series on the state of the Black family, and we're going to have one of those meetings dedicated to grandparenting, so people can look out or watch for announcements related to that if they're interested in meeting us or finding more information.
Why don't you tell us again how people can get in touch with you and your group?
Sure. I can give you my phone number. That is 816-235-2490. 816-235-2490.
And the name of your program again?
Is GPS, Grandparent Support.
this is great. Thank you very much.
Thanks
for having us.
If you missed the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's announcement of the new rules governing the payday and car title loan industry, well, stay tuned.
I am now pleased to introduce Richard Cordray. Prior to his current role as the CFPB's first director, he led the CFPB's enforcement office. Before that, he served on the front lines of consumer protection as Ohio's Attorney General.
Thank you, Zixta. We're here in Kansas City, known as the Heart of America, to discuss concerns about payday lending and other types of loans made to consumers facing an immediate need for cash. We've been here before when we brought an enforcement action to shut down the Hydra Group. This was a predatory online lending scheme that maneuvered people into small dollar loans and then stripped money out of their accounts without their consent. We froze their assets and put them out of business. We also held an earlier field hearing in St. Louis on the other side of the Show Me State. There we learned about loans offered at rates sometimes as high as 1,950% annually, made to consumers who lacked the ability to repay, causing some people to roll over their loans again and again and again. Today we're here to show everyone concerned our new proposed rule on payday loans, auto title loans, and certain high-cost installment and open-end loans. In such markets, where lenders can succeed by setting up borrowers to fail, something needs to change. From the beginning, payday lending has been an important priority for the Consumer Bureau. In the statute creating this new agency, Congress authorized us to exert supervisory authority from the outset over all financial companies in only three specified markets. And one of these is the market for payday loans. In addition, we have the authority to enforce the law against all payday lenders. We've deployed this authority in a number of cases involving both storefront and online lenders, where our investigations have found violations of the law. And we have the authority to write new rules to clean up unfair, deceptive, or abusive practices that harm consumers. That's the purpose of our discussion today. In January of 2012, just after I was appointed as the first director of the Consumer Bureau, we held a field hearing in Birmingham, Alabama, focused on payday lending. These issues have drawn interest from people of diverse backgrounds all over this country. In addition to these public events, we have sat and talked at length with many stakeholders, from consumer groups to lenders to academics. Perhaps most telling of all, we've held numerous sessions with a broad set of faith leaders from across the country. They have shared searing experiences of how payday loans affect the people they care for every day in their churches and mosques and synagogues. And they have described how these loans undermine financial life in their communities. In devising this proposed rule, we've been listening carefully, and we will continue to listen and learn from those who would be most affected by the rule. and we will take their comments into account as we go forward and work to finalize new reforms in this area. Many states, covering tens of millions of people, have maintained strict usury caps that effectively permit only small-dollar loans that are carefully underwritten. The Consumer Bureau, by contrast, does not have authority under our statute to establish a usury limit for such loans, and so our proposal would not do so. More recently, other states created legal frameworks that opened the door to loosely underwritten, high-cost payday loans, auto title loans, and payday installment loans. These newer laws first arose when some check cashing outlets began to hold a customer's personal check for a period of time for a fee before cashing it, which spawned the payday loan business. We have undertaken extensive research to understand how consumers experience these loans today. We've done so with the recognition that people who live from paycheck to paycheck sometimes need access to credit to deal with drops in income or spikes in expenses, as well as times where their income and expenses are mismatched. But at the same time, we've made clear our view that the credit products marketed to these consumers should help them, not hurt them. And our research has shown that too many of these loans trap borrowers in debt they cannot afford instead of tiding them over in an emergency. Specifically, we found that short-term loans with very high annualized interest rates offered over a short period, typically 390% or more for two-week single-payment loans, often result in consumers frequently rolling over these loans. Nearly 4 out of 5 of these loans are reborrowed within a month, usually when the loan is due or immediately thereafter. Approximately 1 in 4 new loans results in a sequence of at least 10 loans, one after the another, made in a desperate struggle to keep up with the payments that are due. Each time, the consumer pays more fees and interest on the same debt, turning a short-term loan into a long-term debt trap. It is much like getting into a taxi, just a ride across town, and finding yourself stuck in a ruinously expensive cross-country journey. Indeed, the very economics of the payday lending business model depend on a substantial percentage of their customers being unable to repay the loan and borrowing again and again at high interest rates, incurring repeated fees as they go along. More than half of all payday loans are made to borrowers in loan sequences of 10 loans or more. For borrowers who are paid weekly or biweekly, 1/5 of the loans are in sequences of 20 loans or more. We uncovered similar issues with single-payment auto title loans, where borrowers use the title to their car or truck as collateral for a loan. The borrower agrees to pay the full amount owed to the lender in a lump sum plus interest and fees in a short time, usually in about 30 days, to get their title back. These are high-cost loans with an annualized interest rate of about 300%. After analyzing over 3 million loan records, we found that these loans are single payment and short term in name only. Only 12% of new loans are repaid in full when due without having to reborrow. By contrast, more than 80% of auto title loans are rolled over or reborrowed on the day they are due because borrowers cannot afford to pay them off in a lump sum. Moreover, 1 in 5 of these short-term auto title loan sequences ends up with the borrower having his or her car or truck seized by the lender because of a failure to repay the loan. When borrowers lose their personal vehicles, they may also lose mobility, which in much of the country, such as where I grew up and where we are here today, can greatly imperil the foundations of people's financial lives. For those who have to walk away from a loan without their car or truck, the collateral damage can be severe if they've relied on it to get to work or to conduct most of their daily affairs. The rule we're proposing today also addresses certain longer-term installment loans and open-end lines of credit. Specifically, the proposal would cover loans for terms longer than 45 days when the lender either collects payment by accessing the consumer's deposit account or paycheck or secures the loan by holding the consumer's auto title as collateral. A particular concern to us are payday installment loans. These are high-cost loans, typically made by lenders who also offer standard payday loans, with the installment payments timed to fall on the consumer's paydays and deploying these types of leverage to extract payments. Some have a balloon payment that has to be repaid after a number of interest-only payments. Our research into payday installment loans revealed that at the end of the day, after accounting for some amount of refinancing activity, more than 1/3 of loan sequences ends in default. Our study of auto title installment loans found similar figures, with loan sequences ending in default nearly one-third of the time. In addition, more than 1 in 10 loan sequences ended with the borrower's car or truck being seized by the lender. Currently, about 16,000 payday loan stores operate in the 36 states where this type of lending takes place, joined by an expanding number of online lending outlets. Some of these lenders also make auto title loans or payday installment loans or both. What they have in common is that they offer quick cash on terms that make it very hard for consumers to pay off the loans on time. And they've devised ways to be profitable without determining whether consumers who take out these loans can actually afford them. In the case of payday and single payment auto title loans, this business model depends critically on repeat borrowing. For payday installment and auto title installment loans, the business model depends primarily on access to a borrower's account or auto title, which provides the lender with the necessary leverage to extract payments even when the borrower cannot afford them. Based on our research and what we've heard around the country, we believe the harm done to consumers by these business models needs to be addressed. As we took up the task of proposing reforms, we spent much time and effort learning about state and tribal regulatory regimes, including many discussions with state payday regulators, state attorneys general, and tribal leaders. Payday lenders already have to comply with federal laws on matters such as truth in lending and debt collection practices. Today, the Consumer Bureau is taking the next step, adding new federal protections against lending practices that harm consumers by trapping them in debt they cannot afford. These strong, common sense protections would apply mainstream lending principles to payday, auto title, and certain other high-cost installment and open-end loans. Traditional lenders, such as community banks, credit unions, and many finance companies, make an effort to determine a borrower's ability to repay before offering a loan with affordable payments. Both the lender and the borrower have a mutual stake in one another's success. But today, the borrower's ability to repay is often entirely absent from the transaction when it comes to payday and other similar loans. Our proposed rule seeks to address these concerns by protecting consumers from such debt traps. Let me first describe how the proposal applies to short-term loans. For these loans, the lender generally would need to apply a full payment test to determine that consumers have the ability to repay the loan without reborrowing. Lenders could also offer a loan with a principal payoff option, but only under specified conditions that are directly designed to ensure that consumers cannot get trapped in an extended cycle of debt. To spell this out further, using the proposed full payment test, lenders making short-term loans would be required to check upfront whether the borrower can afford to pay the full amount of the payment when it comes due without needing to reborrow. Specifically, lenders would need to verify the borrower's income, borrowing history, and certain key obligations. This would determine whether the consumer will have enough money to cover their basic living expenses and other obligations and still pay off the loan when it is due without needing to reborrow in the next 30 days. The proposal further protects against debt traps by making it difficult for lenders to press distressed borrowers into rolling over the same loan or reborrowing shortly after paying it off. And it would cap the number of single payment loans that lenders can offer to a consumer in quick succession. Under the principal payoff option, consumers could borrow a short-term loan up to $500 without passing the full payment test, as long as the loan is directly structured to keep the consumer from getting trapped in debt. Under this option, if a consumer cannot pay off the original debt entirely or returns to borrow within 30 days, the lender could offer no more than 2 extensions to the original loan. And then only if the consumer repays at least one-third of the principal with each extension. This proposal would afford somewhat more flexibility while expressly protecting borrowers against debt traps and providing them with a simpler way to pay off their debt. To further safeguard against extended indebtedness, lenders could not offer this option to any consumer who's been in debt over the preceding year on short-term loans lasting 90 days or more. Our proposal takes the same basic approach to the longer-term loans that it covers. Here again, our proposed rule would generally require lenders to apply the same full payment test to determine whether borrowers can pay what they owe when it is due and still meet their basic living expenses and obligations. For payday and auto title installment loans, either with or without a balloon payment, this means consumers have to be able to afford to repay the full amount when it is due, including any fees or finance charges. Our proposed rule would permit lenders to offer certain longer-term loans without applying the full payment test if their loans meet specific conditions designed to pose less risk to consumers and provide access to responsible credit. In particular, we're not intending to disrupt existing lending by community banks and credit unions that have found efficient and effective ways to make small-dollar loans to consumers that do not lead to debt traps or high rates of failure. Indeed, we want to encourage other lenders to follow their model. Therefore, our proposal would not require lenders to apply the full payment test for loans that generally meet the parameters of the kind of payday alternative loans, known as PAL loans, authorized by the National Credit Union Administration. For these loans, interest rates are capped at 28%, and the application fee is no more than $20. This option would be available to all lenders on the same basis and not just to federal credit unions. Our proposal also would not require the full payment test for certain installment loans that we believe pose less risk to consumers. These loans would have to meet three main conditions. First, they must be for a term of no more than 2 years and be repaid in roughly equal payments. Second, the total cost cannot exceed an all-in percentage rate of 36% plus a reasonable origination fee. Third, the projected annual default rate on all of these loans must not exceed 5%. The lender would have to refund all of the origination fees paid by all borrowers in any year where the annual default rate of 5% is exceeded. Lenders would also be limited as to how many such loans they could make to a consumer each year. The Bureau is also proposing new requirements to address how lenders go about extracting payments from consumer accounts for the type of loans covered by this proposal. From our research, we found that when these attempts failed because they were returned for insufficient funds, online payday and payday installment lenders often made repeated attempts to extract money electronically, even though they were unlikely to succeed in doing so. When these attempts repeatedly fail, consumers risk incurring substantial fees, both for insufficient funds by their bank or credit union and for returned payments by the lender. Some lenders even break up the total amount they're owed into smaller chunks and feed them through the system piecemeal, even though one payment will rarely succeed when another fails. This can lead to multiple penalty fees being assessed on what started out as a single payment, hiking costs for consumers while typically failing to collect any more money. Our research also found that many online payday borrowers lost their bank accounts after one or more failed attempts by a payday lender to extract a payment from the account. For the loans covered by our proposal, lenders would have to give borrowers advance notice before accessing their account to collect a payment. This would give consumers a chance to question or dispute any unauthorized or erroneous payment attempts and to make arrangements for covering payments that are due. We believe this will reduce the risk of consumers being debited for payments they did not authorize or losing their accounts as a result of debits they did not authorize or anticipate. In addition, we propose what we call the debit attempt cutoff. After two straight unsuccessful attempts, the lender could not make further debits on the account without reaching out to the borrower to get a new and specific authorization. This would keep consumers from being slammed by multiplying fees for return payments and insufficient funds. Under all aspects of the proposal we're releasing today, we recognize that consumers may need to borrow money to meet unexpected drops in income or unexpected expenses. We recognize, too, that some lenders serving this market are committed to making loans that consumers can, in fact, afford to repay. We do not intend to disrupt the basic underwriting approaches taken by many banks, credit unions, and traditional finance companies, as well as some newer entrants, which offer installment loans in ways designed to assure that consumers can afford to repay them. We believe these lenders will have little difficulty adhering to our proposed rule. In fact, many elements of our full payment test are based on information these lenders have shared about their approaches. But let me be clear. If a lender can succeed when borrowers are set up to fail, it is a telltale sign of a malfunctioning market. When the balance between lenders and borrowers is knocked askew, the win-win dynamic found in healthy credit markets disappears and puts consumers at great risk. We believe the rule we are proposing would make a positive difference by prompting reforms in the markets for these products. Based on our review of the available evidence, we believe the vast majority of borrowers would still be able to get the credit they need in an emergency, either by passing the full payment test or by utilizing one of the other options. But now they would be shielded by an umbrella of stronger protections that would keep them from getting trapped in debt they cannot afford. As we move forward with this rulemaking process, we're also launching a related inquiry into other situations that may harm consumers. Our request for information will help us learn more about a further range of products and practices that fall outside the scope of this proposal. This includes, for instance, further questions about high-cost, longer-term installment loans and open-end lines of credit that lack vehicle security or an account access feature. We will look into the business model for these loans and the underwriting practices of these lenders. We also want to learn more about the extent to which these loans may keep borrowers on a debt treadmill by applying the payments to interest rather than paying down the principal. And we want to know whether these loans encourage loan churning or discourage early loan repayment. What we learn may affect future rulemaking, and it will clearly help guide our continuing efforts to supervise companies and take enforcement actions against unfair, deceptive, and abusive acts or practices. Missouri's own President Harry Truman notably said, "Every segment of our population and every individual has a right to expect from our government a fair deal." Our proposed rule is designed to ensure more fairness with these financial products by making systemic changes to steer borrowers away from ruinous debt traps and restore to them a larger measure of control over their affairs. Ultimately, our objective is to allow for responsible lending while making sure that consumers do not fall into situations that undermine their financial lives. This hearing and the notice and comment process are important steps. We greatly value the feedback we receive, and we study it carefully. It invariably refines our thinking and our approach, and it makes our final rules better in the end. What we hear from you and from all stakeholders will help us decide how we can better protect financially vulnerable consumers. We ask you to share your thoughts and experiences to help us get there, and we appreciate your joining us today. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lim, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale.